realism is always mentioned, and as a purely bookish question, you have to know it in your exam, even in the comprehensive. Who is in the comprehensive this year, but anyone? Nobody? Well, so it is a topical question of the ordinary course curriculum in philosophy. I have tried last time to bring it near to you by saying that for a man who speaks of God and the gods of the divine, and for men who speak of things, and for men who speak of men, the problem of the universe represents itself in a different manner. This is an approach you do not find in the textbooks. I hold, and that's my own conviction or my own contribution to the whole thing, it is now the latest stage of the discussion with the modern existentialists, with Heidegger and these people, the Kierkegaardians, that when we speak of man as a Frenchman or as a slave or as a free man or as a bundle of nerves or as a psychological mistake, in modern science really man seems like a psychological mistake, that we have to expect that the thing we speak of, man, talks back and say that if you call me an idiot, I shall say you are the idiot. And that is, gentlemen, that if we label people, that was the gist of what I tried to say last time, we have to use mutual universals, mutual. If you call me professor, I have to call you student. If you call somebody father, he has to call you his son. I've just great trouble with a young man who is very enthusiastic about me, which is very nice. And he cooperated on a book, and he contributed to some letters, which I then answered, and he published this as a book. He's a student. And in his great enthusiasm for me, he offered me suddenly to call me father. I was disgusted. I didn't want to be his father at all. I didn't want to replace his very nice father, whom he had, who was a very, very good and fine person. And I thought it was terrible sentimentality. He wanted to get rid of the great challenge of this book, which put him under obligation to do something in the field of intellectual endeavor as my student, you see, or as my collaborator. And instead he wanted to back out and by burying the whole situation in sentiment, you see, and by calling me daddy, he was out of any obligation to do anything. I was still protecting him, you see, and shielding him. And so I have a terrible time now to get out of this fix, because I don't wish to respond with anything like sin-like treatment for him. I want to be very harsh in it, you see, and provoke him to feel adult. He's 25, and so he's not a baby. And to get a letter from this man, dear father, it just turns my stomach. There you see that this is a universal which he tries to apply to me out of place, you see, because I cannot respond. And there you perhaps see very practically that what a universal is in between people. If we have a correspondence, you with perhaps with a Swede, and you say, dear Swede, and he answers, dear American, you see, that is very clear and simple. Most people today in international relations take the liberty of pigeonholing their correspondent by calling him dear Frenchman or dear German, and thinking of him in these terms. And I think I mentioned this last time already, that this is quite a dangerous thing, because if every one of another nation to you is only the representative of this other universal of Sweden or Norway, you see, he'll also only consider you an American. I can tell you give a very practical example of this. I was in Germany for the State Department 2 years ago, and I was asked, what does the American, singular please, the American think of the policy of the United States in Europe? And the only thing I could answer is there are 150 million Americans, perhaps some more, and every American has a right to his own opinion. And you must not ask me what the American thinks
I said, don't be stupid. What does the American think of Germany and the occupation? And I said, my dear man, be careful. If you force me to speak in the name of 155 million Americans in the singular, the American, I'm compelled to speak of the German and say that the German is guilty, has a war guilt, and is guilty of the extinction of the 6 million Jews. So it doesn't pay for you to ask me this silly question, because you must want me to distinguish between the Germans as being different people. You ask me to subsume, you see, but you ask this silly question all the time. I mean, the German, of course, was just Americanized, because all your questionnaires, all the statistics run in the same idiotic direction of lumping together people who don't belong together. Just ask the people in Harlem how they feel now about the Puerto Ricans with whom they are lumped together. Isn't that true? Terrible. They are just figured, you see, for the average American as another colored person. There you have the Harlem with the whole tradition of American civilizations, people serving up and making a place for themselves. In come these low-grade people from Puerto Rico, and they are lumped together, and it's the most depressing experience, catastrophical really, for the leading people in Harlem, that everything they have built up there is now destroyed. Have you ever thought of this injustice that's done to the black people in Harlem by the coming of the Puerto Ricans to Manhattan? Because the other people just say this is just it, all the same. This is the practical significance of the universals today, and you must see that's very explosive. It's the most explosive topic, you see, taking off the fair business, fair employment practices and so on. Where everybody also is simply lumped together, you see, under some category, then you can't get a job. So this is very serious, gentlemen, and you don't know it, because you think this is not a question of your mental vices, but it's a mental vice to call a man a Jew or a Christian or a Pole in this country. You can say he's Jewish, you can say he's Polish, you can say he's colored, if he's black, but you cannot say he is this. That's different. The solution, gentlemen, for the problem of the universals in the social sciences is always to use the adjective and never to use the noun. Because all the things in society are qualities, but they are not identifications. You can have the quality of being called a white man, but you can be as black underneath as possible. Most white men are today, in their hatred and their fear and their insecurity. And so, gentlemen, the universals enter a new phase today in the treatment of human beings. We receive as much as we give when we qualify people. When this German asks me, what does the American think, I am entitled to say, well, if all Americans are alike, according to his supposition, then I can say, the German made the Second World War. The German extinguished Jews, there is never a reconciliation for it. Because all are one. Can you see this? That's the problem of the universe. That all are one. All men are men. Seems very convincing, you see. But according to your image of man you carry inside yourself, you see, you then may have to commit suicide or make a fire and show all the rest of the human race on the fire. Because if they are just, you can't stand them. According to the image you have of the unity. So, the gentlemen, today this question of the universals again is loaded with dynamite. And I only can hint here at the solution in a new era of the social sciences, which is terribly urgent. It shows, gentlemen, that the use of the noun for human beings perhaps may be forbidden. That you can say this man is social, or this man is intelligent, or this man is white, or this man is green, or this man is good, but you cannot say his goodness. You see, you cannot say his virtue, you cannot say he is stupidity. And that's what you really try to say when you give a man the title he's a Russian. Because then he comes under the rubrum of the people with whom you can't have intercourse without jeopardizing your career in General Electric at this moment. So you better have no intercourse with the Russian. I have a friend who's a wonderful man, and he went around and sold his art. And for the last 3 years, he couldn't find employment because he has a Russian name. He was a man who fled Russia from the Bolsheviks 30 years ago. But that doesn't matter, you see. Once a Russian name, always a Russian name. And the poor man who is much more anti-Bolshevik because he, after all, paid the penalty of immigration, you see, can't get employment on a college campus in this country at this moment.
It's improving now, but the last 3 years were very hard on this man because people were crazy from fear of Mr. McCarthy. Only to show you how practical this question of the universals is. Can you see this? No? You can't? What's your question?
You mean all men are one, or men are all different?
Were you here last time?
Yeah.
I tried to tell you that the word universal means the application of general statements to any one object of observation or meditation. I have this here, and I have this here. You would call this a chair, and you would call this, well, you may not, is this a chair? Well, what is universal between them is there are two seats. Now, is this word seat an inherent quality of this chair, or is it arbitrarily invented for me by you? That's the question of the universal. The question of the universal is it a mere fiction of a name arbitrarily applied by your mentality and mind to these two things? Or is inherent in them something that compels you, if you want to speak the truth, to call these two things seats? With regard to, are you forced today to say that the elements are higher units of hydrogen or of electron? The physicist tells you that you have to admit that they are all arrangements of electrons. Is that true? So scientific truth demands from you to call these arrangements of electrons, sir. You are not interested in the truth, I know this, you just talk. But sir, people who are concerned with the truth, they would be very hard put to define to say, what is this process by which I am, in the face of the God, forced to call these two things seats? I'm a horse trader, I'm cheating if I call a mule a horse. You know this. That would be cheating. I can't tell a man who is absent by correspondence a horse, and then the thing arrives and it's a mule. Haven't I cheated? The question of the universal, sir. I say, well, what is a mule? Do you know? What is a mule?
Not a horse.
How do you know? How do you know? What is the son of an American mother and a German father? Is he a German? That's the escapism of the American. Now what's your question, sir? You see, I know you live all in this era of things. From 1500 to 1900, we lived in the era of the natural sciences. Always think that we have the scheme, 1100 to 1500 theology, 1500 to 1900, this knowledge of things, and now beginning the question of this, the question of men. Most sciences we have today, they call themselves social sciences, they are just natural sciences about men trying to treat men as a thing. All psychology does this. Treats men as an object of science. There's no mutuality. So we are still, you are all only living in this era where you say, well, this is not an important question. I call this a seat, I call this a chair, there's a minimum of honesty. It's not a horse, you say, the mule. So he can't get the money for the horse, you see, in law. But as I told you, the ordinary habit of all of you is I call this arbitrarily God. I call this arbitrarily oxygen. I call this arbitrarily democracy. No, there you go. But with most things, you think that you speak arbitrarily, that you label everything according to your will. That is nominalism, gentlemen. And for the last 400 years, we have been under the rule that words apply to things, definitions, what I arbitrarily define so-and-so, is within your power. Nominalism says that to call something with a term is arbitrary, is convention, human agreement. You may have heard that there was a special conference of the physicists in April in which they fixed the new words kappa and superon and neutron and for the electron problems inside the electron. Has anybody heard of this conference? You should. It's very interesting. They had 9 new names bestowed on the various forms, and they had a new term, spin. Have you heard of spin? It's an English term, you understand it. Spinning of the top. So that they say any element or particle has quantity, has charge, electric charge, and has spin. Those terms. Have you heard of it? Very important. It's a new conventional term about, you see, a thing, and we think it's real. But the origin of the name is human, the human mind. And I cannot be forced to give it this name, spin. The physicists have just agreed on this. That is the attitude of the nominalist with regard to the universe. Well, I see already that you are impenetrable. You won't understand. Pardon me?
So you say that we can't call a Russian as such. Well, what is...
You must say... Well, I see the consequences are very bad. Once you begin to say this, you petrify. I mean, you can. Everybody does it. But I'm only showing you... At this moment, I'm not sitting in judgment. I'm only descriptive, sir, of what you do every day. I don't say you cannot, but I say if you do this, you are not a nominalist because you are acting under an obsession. You are obsessed.
Well, sir, I'd like to know what the American is that you always speak of then.
The educational system, that's American, I would say. Anybody, the man on the filling station doesn't come under what I call American usually. He's a normal human being, but you are not. You are not.
Well, that's just it. I mean, throughout the year, you use the term American or America.
Yeah.
And I frankly haven't been able to determine exactly what you mean by that. Whether you mean every American, all 150 million, whether you mean just us in this class here, or whether you mean just the working class.
Well, we have talked quite seriously about 4 mentalities. You remember the French, the German, the English, and the American. And obviously, anybody who falls into the apparatus of the higher strata of the workings of this civilization, of this society, is thereby participating in what I've called, and I think I've clarified, to be American. Otherwise, I think you're a normal human being, that is, you are able to contain elements that are neither French, nor German, nor English, nor American. But these 3-4 forms of education in Oxford, in Dartmouth, in Heidelberg, and in Paris, work you in a special way. They are kind of gymnastics. It's a training. And through this training, you receive certain specific qualities.
Well, I understand that. So it would seem to me that if this training brings about certain qualities that make it possible for you to call an American American, then certain other things that occur in Russia might make it possible to call a Russian a Russian.
Oh, undoubtedly. Problem is why you say it is better to use the adjective than the noun is, because it allows the Russian to be Russian plus X, and it allows you to be American plus X. You see, I always think that every human being is bigger than any label you can pin on him. So if I speak of the American, he's always free to surprise me by being better than what I call the American. You see, every one of us is half known and half unknown. You see? And whenever I say, this is known of you, the man can slap me in the face and say, but you, I don't know only half of you. The rest is still free and to come. You understand?
Yeah.
The problem of the humanities, gentlemen, is that you have to treat your vis-a-vis as that, what you know of him, plus what you don't know of him. You see? Whereas in natural science, you say, I know everything about him. Because it's a thing. About this chair you really, you can treat this chair as known, as analyzable. Weight, quantity, shape, you see, composition, material, price, everything can be known about it. See, that's the thing. And it doesn't sigh and say, please treat me as a living being when you get a fairy tale teller. He begins to treat the things as things who can talk back. And they become to life, isn't that true? And at the moment, anything comes to life, it is more than is known.
Well, it seems to me that some of the things that you condemn that seem to you to be typically American are not necessarily the things that you spoke of as the half that you know. I mean, I would think that they would be not in every American, but in every individual as such. In other words, if you say the American has a different regard for family outlook, and you speak of various aspects of that, it doesn't seem to me that that's a general thing that applies to every person in America, but just the other half, the part that would apply to some and not to others.
Wonderful. I fully accept this criticism. You talk back. You see, we are in the social sciences. You have the perfect right to say this doesn't apply to the families you know. And I only can offer this as an explanation of a certain number of features, you see, which you perhaps also know. And you can say, but I know families where it doesn't fit. Because they are alive. They can always define me. Any criticism in society invites already the remedy that some people cease to be that way. And my criticism, of course, has been applied for centuries, so some people have always steered clear of the ways I describe. You're quite right. There is no such thing in human society where a universal really is valid forever. It isn't. You must understand this. That's why I give you these 10 commandments, in order to show that at every one moment, the mind changes, doesn't it? I mean, this was an appeal to your sense of life. Don't you see this? That the same mental quality appears in a child as listening and in a ruler as a command, after all, shows you how free you have to be to understand all these words which I use. You see, you have to be able to realize that they appear in any one moment in different forms.
Sir?
No, one moment. Let me first finish this, because otherwise we will never get over the first I have to get through this. Afterwards, gentlemen, with regard to men, I told you that we cannot be realists and we cannot be nominalists. At this moment, I want to leave the solution in suspense. When we deal with the social sciences at the end of the course, we'll have to come back to this question, gentlemen, how we speak to each other. But one concept you may put down, the whole problem is neither nominalism or realism simply because it is mutuality. I won't call it mutualism, that would be too terrible. The problem of the use of general terms among people is a question of saluting each other. And the way you are introduced to another person is something that can only be handled if he is introduced to you and you are introduced to him at the same time. And so the question of mutuality is paramount. Can you understand this? Sir, do you understand this?
Yeah.
Therefore, the question is suddenly on a new plane where you have two people who are want to call each other with the right name. The question is never of labeling one object, but of two subjects calling upon each other in the right manner. And you know how important it is when you speak to the dean, to call a dean. The problem of the priests of the Middle Ages and of the monks who went to Paris or to Bologna to study canon law or medicine or theology was the question, was God purely a name in the bad sense of figment of their own imagination? Was it just a purely same convention as at this conference in the Pyrenees where they now fix the term superon on a neutron, on some poor parts of the electron, without the electron having any cord of appeal? Is God a neutron? Is God a superon? Is God a hysteron? Is it just his child? That's what you think. You think, what I arbitrarily call God. Now, gentlemen, I tried and I made a shortcut and you didn't understand it. So that's why I'm back to this once more. I tried to tell you that when you are the priest of God Almighty, who has become known from generation to generation through the ages, and if you are an elder in society who has this strange task of tying together three generations who all must speak a different language, who all fall at a different mental stage, of whom one is a child who just learns the ABC, the other is a fighter who wants to reason out his own philosophy, and the third is a real ruler, like President Eisenhower, who has to hold together the country between McCarthy and Truman. Then you have the problem of not speaking arbitrarily. Mr. The man who today makes the 4th of July a press gentleman cannot speak of those people who began to act wildly against the British in 1776. He has to call them the founding fathers by danger of excommunication and by danger of threatening the Commonwealth of the United States. He has to call them the founding fathers because he only speaks in all the authority of their name. You only come to his bonfire and to his 4th of July speech because you assume that he is in the line of President Washington. When you come to commencement, the president of this college has to speak as president of Dartmouth College because that's why you are there. That's why you listen to him, and that's why he can make himself heard. Now, gentlemen, here I put this question before you. What is this then, this universal of president of Dartmouth College, when you sit there at commencement? That's very serious. This last generation of you, who have read the funnies only, has brushed aside all these questions. I said, that's no question. You haven't been interested in the truth, gentlemen. You have always been glibly said, oh, that's just John Sloan Dickey, Johnny perhaps, I don't know how you call it. But certainly you have never felt what a strange road you travel on which you are forced to speak of the president of Dartmouth College as a man who can make and break you, who can give you a diploma or can withhold it. He's an authority. As we say in the Ezra Wheeler succession, that's his official, the official paraphernalia of this. Now, within Dartmouth, you have a certain feeling of this name, of this authority. Outside, you haven't. You have lost all respect for all sacred names, which I call arbitrarily God. That's your attitude. except on Sunday when you make a pious face and go with your parents. But otherwise, what is sacred? There are no sacred cows. You say it's all just labels. You can look into the website and you say, instead of God, I can say idol, and instead of idol, I can say the divine, and instead of the divine, I can say the sublime, and so from the sublime to the ridiculous as the rest one step. No. And so, gentlemen, the question of our gods, the question of the spirits which we invoke in order to make ourselves heard, the spirit in which you are allowed to get up in the student council and make a proposal, the right which this gentleman at this moment claimed to make himself heard here in class, so because he's all men are born equal. This right is a very strange thing, gentlemen, because it is a universal which does not apply to your flesh, and it doesn't apply to this chair, to the manufactured things of reality, to stones, but you owe it as participants of the spirit of God. You can make yourself heard because into every human being God has sent one spark of his own presence. And you have a right to be heard only as long as I believe in God. Otherwise I can hang you. Or burn you like Hitler did with the Jews because he didn't believe in God. Very simple. Whatever I have to do with other animals, I crush fleas, I crush insects, so why can't I crush another race? I have nothing to do. Where is it written that other people have any rights? In themselves they can't, otherwise you couldn't go to war. But we go to war when they represent a wrong spirit, when they threaten our own tradition. And we feel that we are in a righteous war. Gentlemen, these are the question of your very existence once you are drafted. You must know whether you can shoot or not shoot. The conscientious objector says he can't. You have to know where you stand, whether you want to suffer then in a conscientious objector camp for the rest of your life. So the question of the universal, gentlemen, is the question of your place in reality, of your rights against other people. You can talk of the Russians, you see, in natural science terms, as long as they aren't here in this room. But if you have armed Bolsheviks here with the hydrogen bomb in this room at this moment, I'm here to talk. I better watch out how I can invoke their, you see, loyalty to listen to me. What can I have to say to these poor Russians? They claim you have offended us, you have only called us Russians. We are the representatives of the great world revolution, they say, of course. They not say they are Russians. They will not accept my label. They say, we have a different term. You are an obstinate capitalist, and you are going to be executed. You are, have been intellectual. You are, as they call us, airmen, you see. Men of the air, no roots in reality. But we are the soldiers of the future, and therefore, out you go. And they have their universes, we have our universes. They are both leading to the extinction of the opposite. So, gentlemen, the question of the universes is the question whether Europe was going to remain Christian in 1100. It's a question that in 1500 it lost interest in this question and turned to the world of things. And that you are completely blinded by this world of things and think that man has the right to call everything arbitrary. Will you take this down, gentlemen? Man can call everything arbitrarily if he can agree with his fellow men on how to call this thing arbitrarily. It is a conference of scientists which gives the name neutron. So, gentlemen, the problem of the universes gets always dark and obscured at the very moment when you forget the great problem how one man agrees with all other men. You think, oh, the scientists agree. They always disagree. Don't be straight, you see.
They only agree for a certain one. And so I told you that in science, the universal is fixed temporarily according to the state of the science. And every generation or every 10 years or every 5 years, the world of science must change or there is no progress. And the progress involves the doctor ignorantia, the learned ignorance, that is, the power to forget what I have said before and how the neutron was called 50 years ago. There was no neutron, there are no neutrons, as you know. And you may be sure that 150 years from now there will be no neutrons either. Yet you put up with this strange saying, gentlemen, and we take down what the following law. For things, every moment of time can have a universal under the condition that in due time it is given up and replaced by another. Things are labeled temporary. This is called a seat or a chair. Now in Volapük or Esperanto it's called, this is a different word, it doesn't matter. Temporarily, in the thing that things which cannot talk themselves are labeled one way or the other by all men at the same time. Everything that is an automobile is today called an automobile over the whole world. And that has blinded you. In all your politics, you only think of the moment. You want to have the United Nations functioning in 1954. Gentlemen, reasonable people don't think so. They are thinking of the future of mankind, of the year 3000. And therefore, they don't want a tyranny established in 1954. And yeah, I'm very glad that there is Russia in America, because otherwise we would have nothing to live for. And all these stupid people who say union now, they just don't know what they're talking about, because they only think of a state of affairs in which all people at this moment agree on a thing, a dead thing. That's why. Now, gentlemen, the problem of the universe is when applied to human beings and when applied to the divine is quite different. The divine are the names for those elements of life or those powers in our life who bind all people of all times, despite the difference of time. God is He who has created the world and will go to the last judgment. And therefore you cannot arbitrarily define God. So gentlemen, on this axis, the things are labeled every day differently. If this is now 1800, and if this is 1850, and if this is 1900, and if this is 1950, then obviously, gentlemen, the universes for chairs, for seats, for locomotives, for automobiles, are in every 1 year identical, and every 50 years they differ. The problem of God is the problem to have one name through all ages. That's a problem you have never asked. That's why you do not know what God is about. One boy came to me, I said, he opened Revelation, tried to read it and didn't understand it. He thought it was a stupid book. Well, he has a ruined brain. A man who deals today with caterpillars and automobiles certainly doesn't know anything what he's talking about when he tries to understand Revelation. Revelation is the book of the identity of the name of the divine in the Old and the New Testament. Since he has never asked, never shared the endeavor, the concern of the believer, he cannot understand religion. You have not this concern to share the faith of the founding fathers, gentlemen. Once you have this, you have certainly a different new problem. Because all you have to find is that name which you and they have in common. So you cannot type over the name. You cease to be a nominalist, you cease to be a mutualist, you have to be a realist. With regard to all those powers who cannot change through time, by the essence of you and I being in the same boat as Adam and Eve, the names cannot be tampered with. And that's called realism. Because it means that the names have an authority, a power, of which you and I can be destroyers, but you cannot be creators.
You can destroy them. You can be an atheist. You can deny them. You can be a skeptic. You can be a cynic. You can be a New Yorker. But I prefer to be a fundamentalist. Because I at least know what I'm dealing with. I'm dealing with the cement and mortar between the different times of the human race. And the cynic and skeptic who says, oh, just finish the name God or Jesus Christ or so, we are through with this, doesn't even know what the problem is. He says, I don't need it. I go on the Long Island Railroad every morning to my office and that's all I need. And what follows after his grave and what went on before he was born is no concern of his. And so he is a degenerate. And we call a degenerate a man who lives in his own generation without connection with the past and the future. That's a degenerate. And the modern American, pardon me, though again making the simplification, as far as he is publicly appealed to, is appealed to by the standard of living and by all things of an ephemeral character. That's the official talk of the town. That's how the elections are run, on issues of the moment. How much wheat fetches? Is this an election issue for the great country? Or all the things you see, when will the McCarthy investigation be called off to prepare the elections in due time for the Republican Party? Is this worthy of 155 million people who have to prepare the future of the world? Pardon me, but there you see how important it is, you see, to appeal to the Christian or the believer in the American who, at this moment, denies that this is part of the American heritage. Of course, I can have a claim to say this is true Americanism, you see. And there's the American element in the Pilgrim Fathers, certainly, who thought that they were building up the kingdom of God for hundreds of years to come. So, I have to this duty, gentlemen, against the textbooks of philosophy, I'm sorry, to insist that I introduce you into something that will be with you for the rest of your lives, this problem, how to deal with the divine, how to deal with things, and how to deal with men, gentlemen, shows you that the universals appear always in three different aspects. If you think that the belief in, let us say, in the holiness of wisdom, the fourth person of the deity, as the Greek church calls it, is not a religious question, but a philosophical question, you will say it's a nominal question, because you treat it as a thing. If you say it's a real thing, the Trinity, I have to speak of these names as indispensable. You look up to them, and you try to bind them to the future and the future to them. If you call the people Greek Orthodox or Protestant or Catholic, you use the terms mutually, because the Greek Orthodox will say, you see, you are Protestant. If you call me an Easterner, I call you a Westerner. Then the Protestant will say, Westerner. I thought I was Protestant. We're not like that. And especially the Protestants, the Roman Catholics, don't like that the Easterners treat them as equally bad. You see, for a Greek Orthodox, the Roman Catholics are as heretical as the Protestants. So the Roman Catholics in this country are very nervous when the Greek Orthodox begin to talk, because all the time the Roman Catholics in this country have used the universal, the heretics are the Protestants, we are the Orthodox. And now suddenly there's an Orthodox church that says, the real offender, the real heretic is the Pope in Rome. Hey, you see what the universals do? So, gentlemen, the universals are three methods. The nominalistic, the realistic, and the neutral element are always in the use of the universals. I'll give you something very important, gentlemen, which, as I said, nobody else will ever tell you. This is my own contribution to this doctrine. And only in the light of this practical today doctrine will you understand the passion of the medieval schoolmen who expressed the same thing in a quite a different manner. Because they always had, of course, the invocation.
educational trinity at heart. And they knew that once they would allow the names under which God was invoked to be just called nominalistically figments of the human mind, that then their whole unity, the necessary unity of St. Augustine in the university, would fall to pieces, because they would have no name in which they would have to serve the truth, in which they would be crusaders for the progress of science. Because under what heading do I meet my colleague in the Department of Philosophy today, Mr. Mandelbaum? You certainly are so different as can be. In the name of the Trinity, in the name of that truth which is given to man to reveal in his own life, and which is also objectively true, you see, beyond him and his own time, which he, Mr. Mandelbaum, and I have to tell through this generation so that it can reach the next generation. This is our obligation. Otherwise, we could teach together in the same department. It's a very complicated process, gentlemen, under which you are exposed to the different opinions of the dubious. But it's always something necessary, you remember? In necessaris unitas, the unity in the necessary. It's bad enough at this moment, because many of my colleagues have forgotten that there's a necessary unity. They have achieved loyalty to Dartmouth College, he said. That's not enough, gentlemen. I must be able to criticize Dartmouth College. I cannot serve you in my full capacity of a teacher if I am not free to criticize Dartmouth. That's not the name in which I speak to you. Isn't that true? I must speak in the greater name of a greater truth than Dartmouth.
Does spirit exist in Paris?
Pardon me?
Does this spirit exist between the two schools in Paris?
Pardon me?
Does this spirit exist between the two schools?
Oh yes, they were both priests. They went to Mass together. They prayed for each other. You see, loved their enemy. They were enemies, you see, but they loved each other. You're quite right, is the question is, of course, that it nearly always broke down. But in Bonaventura and Thomas, I told you, it came to the most wonderful flowering. They were as different as can be. And they loved each other. Feeling that the other was, went away on which the other could not. You give me a good point. I'll come back to this in 10 minutes. But let me put the universal doctrine straightway. Then you will express it in a rather, well, as I said, in a schoolbook manner. They said the universals can be considered as being iterant in re or postulant. Now, I give you my explanation to encourage you to look through these rather abstract words. This means the universal exists, the universal man exists before you and I exist. They are ideas of God. They are Platonic realities, you see. That's a Platonism. Mm-hmm. The chair is a preconceived idea that is real. And this is only a set case of this idea of the chair. That's the so-called idealistic position, which is valid for the divine. God's name precedes me. Well, I come to this. This is the Platonic position. This is the Aristotelian position, gentlemen. And this is the nominalistic position. This means, oh, first I find here a chaos of things. Chairs and blackboards and nails and pin pricks here and something, a piece of paper. And I'm forced in order to get make order, as you think you're all nominalists, I then arbitrarily classify these things. You stand here in this room and you say, well, these things all look similar. I call them seeds. Then I have this metal, I call this metal here. And then I have here these strange people with their sweaters. I call them students. And the people who mend with the tie, I call it professor. And you see this over here, there's one man with a tie, two men with a tie, and they are semi-professors.
It works.
you think, and you're quite sure that arbitrarily you can at this moment invent the terms to describe the content of this room. And you believe this, because we are just all manufactured people of the modern technical age. You think these are verbs, these are widows, and you invent these terms in common agreement at this moment, or if you have a new thing which you discover, these are curtains, and so on, the blackboard, etc. Gentlemen, that means that your universal comes only after the things exist. And they are figments of the human mind. And they can be arbitrarily shifted. And now, gentlemen, of course, you can just look at the content of this room and you can see that the universal are postulant. Birds and seats have also existed before the chair was made, because the manufacturer went and said, ah, let us make chairs. And the other said, let us make birds. And he had very much the bird in his head before he had them in his hand. And so the same thing to which to you seems to be a universal postulate, the term chair, to the entrepreneur and to the inventor, of course, is the thing which he first had in his mind and was compelled to make under the impact of his idea that this thing already did exist. And then was incarnated and came into being, and here are so many specimens of this one idea of his. Well, if you take the humanistic, you are ever of the modern manufactured and manipulated animal, man, you will see that you call the things arbitrary. And therefore you will then hold the nominalistic position that the name of a thing comes after the thing is created. The Aristotelian position says, this is what chaotically, in the chaos of things, this is unique. Everything is unique. But there is an appeal this thing makes to me to find out its similarity, its semblance with other things. And so the same thing, gentlemen, is specific and general. In itself, the dividing line in this sphere is that it is something original, which cannot be, you see, found in any other chair, because it's this chair. If you put the same chair here a second time, it is still not this chair, you see, but just the second chair. On the other hand, I'm forced to call chair number one and chair number two chair. If I want to remain reasonable, I have to do this for economic reasons. And so, gentlemen, Aristotle and the so-called middle group say that the universals are in re. That is, we are forced to find that by which this thing is equal or identical with other things, at the same time that we notice that it is not equal. The similarity and the dissimilarity are a challenge which has to be met. We are forced to state what is the same and what is not the same in this thing with some other part of the universe. This is a middle term. And the first, as I said, says that the universes were first in the mind of the creator, whether it's a manufacturer who makes chairs or bulbs, Thomas Alva Edison, would be God Almighty with regard to bulbs. And with regard to you and me, the power that made us would be the one who had the idea of a man in his mind when he created Adam, and you and I are specimens of the species man, which you also cannot deny. So the medieval mind, gentlemen, starting with God, was led to believe first in realism, that the And then the end of the Middle Ages, when the interest in things developed, led in the 15th century or 14th century to Noumenon. The way of the medieval mind is from realism to Noumenon. And the Middle Ages end when Noumenonism takes the lead. And the man who represents this nominalism in the 50s, at the end of the Middle Ages, is a man called Ockham. He is the man who says postgrad. He introduced the sophist era, where they said no sacred cows, no names of God, everything arbitrary. That's the cradle of modern natural science. Because it is correct to say this with regard to things, to transient things. That part of you and me which is transient must be treated in such a way that you can every day give a better term for this part of me which is changing. Whether you call this my body as composed out of the four humors, as the doctor said in the Middle Ages, or whether you say today that I am composed out of cells, that has to be left for you. Next day they will say I am composed out of electrons, and I don't know what they will say in the end. So, gentlemen, the description of the mortal part, of the thing part, the objective part of you and me, must be left to the nominalists. There will always be, with regard to things between you and me, that I have to say, you are an American, that is, there is a similarity between you and other Americans, but that's not all you are. The dividing line will always have to be found between your being similar or identical with other Americans and being not similar. You see that in a very young way, help us out in the social, the sociological situation, because they say, yes, there is a similarity which entitles me to say American, but I must be careful to say, you see, that this is never the whole story for the individual. You understand? Now, the third solution is with regard to those names under which we go to work together, or hold peace together. You have to invoke, if you want to write a peace treaty, gentlemen, between the United States and Germany, which hasn't been written yet, as you know, probably never will be written, you would have to invoke peace. That is, both parties would have to say we bow to the necessity to end the war and to make peace. Obviously, they could not say we call it arbitrary war and we call it arbitrary peace. It would make no sense. They must bow to what is peace. Peace is real. And there's only one state that is really fully peace, and there's only one state that is fully war, and there are many states in between. But peace and war are not your arbitrary figments of the imagination. Once you say this, you are in hell. The cynics, the devil, says there's no difference between peace and war. And you are never, ever the average educated person in the Western world, gentlemen, is so inferior to the Russian mind, because the Russians believe in only, that is, they believe in a divine element, in one element of the divine, in the historical creative process. And you don't believe in God in reality at all, because you really think that you can pick and choose. A lady said the other day to me that she couldn't go to church because some group in the church, some committee had collected money, and then they had got to dinner on this morning, which they had collected, and said, we have worked so hard, let's have a good time. So she was so shocked that she left the church. Well, I said, have you ever thought that these rascals need the church and you might need the church? That is, have you only asked the question if you like the church? That's treating the church as a universal constraint. First you know what you want and then you try to find it. And you put the label on it. Gentlemen, that's not the way, unfortunately, we live in the real world. You are born an American, and you can't invent Christianity at this moment. Or the right religion. It's beyond you and me, you see. You have to find the lifeline of the human race from beginning to end. You can join that cavalcade.
But it isn't up to you to find a better religion. That's only for people in Los Angeles.
This, however, you think. That is, gentlemen, I want you to understand. The question of the universal is debated in the textbooks as though it was dealing with everything under the sun, God, men, and things, in three aspects. Before, in, and after the thing is before us. That's not true. We are mobile and flexible and dynamic people today, and we know that if you look up to the powers that rule us, you use your language in one way. If you speak of commercial things, you use your language in another way. And if you speak to other people, you use again your language in a different aspect. These are three modes of speech and three modes of thinking, which you all three must apply. There is no one-way street to beatitude, but that's what you think. You think that you have to define your thinking and your terminology and your method of speech and your behavior in a one-way street. Gentlemen, the people who dealt with the universals entered this tremendous experience that man must speak to men, to things, and to God, of the gods and to the gods in a different manner. The founding fathers of this country can only be spoken of as the founding fathers. You cannot speak of them as these countries, because then you destroy your American heritage. Isn't that true? You cannot debunk your reporting with any meaning. You cease to be an American. That's very, at least you must know what you're doing then. Then you must put something better in its place. I have to appeal to you to in these simple terms of founding fathers, because you have lost sight of the higher units of the Trinity and the Church. That's not sacred to you anymore. But I think that any American, whether he admits it or not, does want to speak, has the right to speak of the founding fathers with some meaning. And you still want to speak of Abraham Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address. And you can only do this if you hold on to the universal under wrap. That is, that you are forced to use these names as sacred in order to be listened to be obeyed, to be able to be a judge in the court of the United States and to execute justice. Because you cannot judge a criminal unless you can invoke the laws of the United States. And by invoking the laws or the Constitution of the United States, you appear to compelling names. They are not figments of your imagination or anywhere on one's mind. What is the difference, gentlemen? They are historical decisions. They have come true. They have been verified. And there is this one thing I offer you to get beyond your textbook knowledge and your department of your studies. That is that the whole law of the universe hinges on one experience which you have made yet, but which you must make in your life. That's the verification of your own truth. You remember that we introduced this grand train of protest and suffering after doubt. Now, when a man has said this is so, and he's willing to say it like stick his neck out for it, and then he takes the poison, as John Quincy Adams, or Plato, or John the Cardinal Newman, you see. That which he has said becomes verified, and he cannot vanish, he cannot go behind it, he has said it. And his whole life is in it. And once we are the heirs of the founding fathers or of Plato or of Newman, we cannot go behind this name and say, we call it arbitrarily, onism instead of Platonism. You have to call it Platonism. Plato has a right to be mentioned in our life as representing a part of reality. The name, gentlemen, of God, of Christ, of Plato, of Caesar, of Mark Antony, of the opera, whatever name you take in your mouth, the names are compelling. You have to use them to be understood.
And in whose line of succession you want to act. Now your question.
It goes back to your religious argument. You made a statement that throughout the ages God has been known by all men. And although he has been known, he's not been proved. There have been proofs such as the unmoved move of the first cause and all those. But there has never been a proof that has satisfied everybody.
Okay.
Not
cannot be proved.
Okay. And at that point, would you agree that it's a safe assumption to make that God will never be conclusively proven?
Of course, automatically would be good.
And we go on. Then you went on to say, quote, that one can't arbitrarily define God.
Exactly.
Well, if there is no standard God, then mustn't one arbitrarily define God? Or you also said that you can't invent religion.
Oh.
If there is no standard God,
you
can't invent religion.
Very simple. Very simple.
In your human figments of the mind, we define our terms. Here we call each other by a mutual name. But God we invoke. And God is not a concept. He cannot be defined. The first definition of God is that he cannot be defined. It's a negative one. All the conceptual knowledge of God is that he is not what you think he is. The first scholastic or the first founder of medieval theology is Antonin Kantor, as I told you. And he begins his great statement with an exclamation. If to any priest a penitent comes and says, I have sinned so deeply, as today a man comes to a psychoanalyst, very much and he is in despair because he has committed some sexual crime. That's why he's usually in despair. Or he's frustrated sexually. So he feels he's wrong to the core. And he says to the psychoanalyst who puts him on the couch, I cannot tell you this, my sins are scarlet-like, and nobody can forgive me. Then he is so surprised because the first thing the psychoanalyst does, he remains immobile and quite indifferent to all the terrible sexual stuff that is talked about there. And that's a great relief to the patient because he thinks nobody could stomach all this dirt. Now the same thing, exactly the same, is at the beginning of Western man's emancipation of thought, that the penitent comes to the priest, as I told you, and says, God cannot forgive me because I am too great a criminal. I'm too great a swine. You know what, then, Anselm's great scholastic foundation cornerstone was? Then thou shalt tell him that God is greater than what he thinks he is. That's exactly the answer to this. God is beyond the definition this man can give of God. And this is the living experience you and I always make, that I mean, with all of my systems and definitions, there's always one power that is greater. For example, my dear man, here we are, and I'm talking, and I think I know you, you're my student. Now you make this question. From this moment on, you are the same man who you were before, plus what you have said. This little element of life is undefined. Because it is something that didn't exist before. You hardly knew that you were going to say this half an hour ago. Now you have said it. Now you are the man in class who has said this. That is, you have decarcerated. You have unchained yourself, you are beyond the definable human being which we thought we all knew before. So we all live on to the next word we have to say. And in speaking, sir, you take part in the revelation of God among men. Because by what men say, the Creator is known through his creatures. And therefore, you are absolutely right to say God cannot be defined. That he can be invoked. That's something quite different. We invoke what we, whom we know to rule us. We define what we know we can
make ourselves or enemies. And to see the line enemies between who and what. Now you and I, sir, are in a strange human position. We are half what and half who. In as far as you can speak to me and to the others, who are a person, who are who. In as far as I can put you on the scales and describe your hair and your sweater, etc., you are one, you are all. And we are also mortals who participate in our dividedness, in our mortality, and you will be put in a coffin one day, and I will be put in a coffin one day, and we will be spoiled again, and cease, you see, to be separate. So every human being, gentlemen, is half definable and half indefinable. Isn't that true? Can you see this? And this is what forces men always to talk in these three ways. By the power you have to speak to me, you can add life. And in bringing this life to bear on that, the system in you enters, which entered 5 minutes before. After you have spoken, there is a new spark in the universe. And in power of my our listening to you and your speaking this, we are moved forward to a new moment in the history of creation of the world. Gentlemen, that's indefinable before, because it hasn't happened. It hasn't happened before. Now, if you were quite alone, the only man in the universe endowed with immortality, man and God would be identical. There would be no reason, you see, for this kingdom to be the last thing, God and you. Because you would be immortal, you would never die, and so you would also have no brothers, no fathers, no grandchildren to care of. You would be God in your own right. And on the other hand, sir, if you couldn't speak, if you were just a brute animal, there would be no reason to exempt you from these things. The whole question of the universe only exists because we are tripartite beings. We are half under the care of others, and we are half endowed with the care for others. And we are mixed in between, fighting for our own existence between those who have cared for us before and those who are for whom we are going to care in the future. You remember again our Ten Commandments and the three stages of life, the child, the adult, and the elder. Whoever has an office in the society, gentlemen, partakes in the sacred names in whose name you are sent to school, for example. And you pay taxes. And you are protected by the police. In power of your individuality, you are fighting your way through college now, and you are later making a living on your own. And with regard to your childishness, you are not responsible for what you say. You're an object of other people's care. Every human being, gentlemen, represents this problem of the universals, because every one of you wants to be treated in part as an objective man. So if you have an appendix, you want to have treated an objective. It must be operated. It has become so dead that it can be taken out and you remain as a living being as the appendices in the glass bottle. Isn't that true? If you only could see that if it's a question of the universals, the medieval people and you are brothers. They have dealt with exactly our problem. And it appears only in a scholastic dress because they were on the other side of the natural world. They have not yet lowered their standards and denied that anything was beyond the arbiter. I mean, a medieval man like Thomas Aquinas, of course, could never expect a state of affairs in which people in darkness would say that they would say arbitrarily God. That was beyond. They had 400 years of Christmas. So they didn't have this strange humanity which really thinks that it can make everything by manufacturing.
life and artificial insemination and whatnot. I there's nothing the American people are not told they can produce arbitrarily. I'm told that students sell their sperm freely to ladies who otherwise can't have children. Isn't that true? I don't know no details, but it must be true. That in all girls' colleges they are told that this is a way to have children if their husband happens to be impotent. Nice story. I mean, mass production. Isn't it true? Is it true? I would like to know. I mean, you see, you can't write about this to the New York Times. They won't tell you.
Two women have
conceived children through that. Well, I was told that this is the topic of teaching in girls' colleges. Is it true?
I know it's a topic of teaching in medical schools.
What?
I know it is in medical schools. I don't know whether it is in girls' colleges.
Well, yeah, there you go. So it is very hard for you to believe that there are certain elements of life, gentlemen, that are not things. You believe that everything is a thing. That's really your indulgence or your weakness. Please investigate. Perhaps you take this down. The question is, you have to answer yourself, if you want to understand the whole process of the mind, is everything a thing? Is everything a thing? By saying everything, you usually mean that you have said everything. But gentlemen, of yourself and of your father, you must not speak as sitting. Once you begin to think of yourself a thing, of course, the rest is suicide. There's no reason why you shouldn't destroy yourself. Suicide is always a case in which a man is so schizophrenic that he treats himself at the same time as an object and a subject. And he says, since I am just an object of my own will and imagination and decision, I shoot myself. Very simple. It's the ultimate of monism, because you become a thing. And this is really the decision, that anybody who says that suicide is normal cannot understand the process of the human spirit, the founding of universities or the progress of science. Suicide is the limiting concept, gentlemen. If you say that a man can commit suicide, that is just as right as not to commit suicide, that's a modern freer form of atheism. And it's a very, very difficult thing you have to face there, because I have not found in this college one man, that's very strange, but and not one woman, which is worse. Well, I have not found, yes, that's true, because I don't doubt that there are, but I have not found them who say that suicide is out. And that's why we are such a bad shape. Because once you give to men the quality of being a thing, you see, you cannot invoke God over his head, you cannot go to your friend and say you cannot commit suicide. For this you have to invoke the higher powers, you have to remind him that he cannot. Not just that he may not. And that's always the invocation of something indefinable. If you and I can be defined, you can take care of. No problem. So perhaps you take this down, then. But in 1954, the form of the universal takes the form of the criterion of human dignity or human suicide. In the Middle Ages, it took the form of the invocation of God. In between, it took the form of the labeling of things. Once you have understood this, you are in the living process of our great Western tradition. That you have to learn, gentlemen, that there are three languages about God, men, and things we have to speak different. This is your whole question. I don't know, you don't believe this. But I can tell you that this is the deciding criterion by which you either will survive or not survive. Your own generation. We have to speak of the gods, we have to speak of men, and we have to speak of things in a different manner. Because we have to speak to people, we have to invoke the gods, and we have to label that thing. You are quite free to label this a chair or a seat or an army truck or what are you, I'm not calling it a kind of boy. Woe to you if you call me arbitrary. And woe to you if you call the founding fathers a fraud. You can't do this. Thank you.